Mr. Atkind, reel 21. Mr. Atkind, at the end of the last reel, we were talking about your reasons for not going to live with the relatives you'd contacted at that stage. Can you continue with that explanation?
Yes, we obviously were being helped by the Jewish organizations, but it's a difference between being assisted by a faceless organization to whom you are. You don't have to be grateful. And the difference is going to a relative and becoming a burden. I didn't want to do that for the time being. And therefore I thanked them for the offer. But I said that for the time being I would stay in England and see what will happen.
Did many of the boys and girls leave and go to relatives?
Not many. Maybe I would say about between 10% and 20%.
Did many of them find that close relatives had survived, like immediate family?
Not many immediate families, no. Very few. But many had relatives in America and in Palestine or in other countries and I would say between 10% and 20% went abroad within the first year or two.
How would yourself and the others react if another member of the group found that their mother or father or brother or sister had survived? Was that upsetting for you because yours hadn't? Or?
No, not at all, no. That's not my reaction at all. It was just, well, we knew that survival was a matter of luck, and 99% point something were unlucky, and very, very few were lucky to have a father or a mother or someone else who did survive.
Whilst you were at Windermere, were you given any advice as to how you should continue now with your education?
Well, we were divided into groups and dispersed all over Britain, and because I was in the group, the ones who were ill, who had active TB mainly, were taken to proper hospitals. I was in a group which needed a year's rest for some reason, for physical reasons. And we went to Scotland, about 30 of us. There were no girls, only 30 young men. And we went to a very isolated, beautiful place, not far away from Helensburgh. And we spent the whole summer, we spent a year in there.
What was the place called?
Darlith House. Not far from, it's between Dumbarton and Helensburgh. Was a big secluded house in the middle of nowhere, and there was an English matron who was in charge of us. We liked her very much, and teachers used to come. We were divided into groups, I think into three groups. I was in the top group, the ones that sort of, we had university students coming to teach us, and English, math, history. And we spent the winter and the summer 1946, and then in the autumn of 1946 we were moved to Glasgow to another hostel. And at that time we were approached and sort of more or less asked that we will have to decide on what we would like to, what kind of jobs we would like to have.
What did you decide?
Well, one of the men who came, he said that there is a vacancy in an architect's office, and I immediately raised my hand and I said I would like to work in that office.
In Glasgow,
yes. I was good at drawing, And I was good at all my studies. By then I was preparing for an examination and I passed many subjects. It was College of Preceptors. I don't know if it's still in existence. But it was probably something equivalent to the present O-level standards. Then I took another exam, entrance exam to the Glasgow University, which is higher standard. And again I passed everything except English. I passed the English in the College of Preceptors. I had to take the English exam again, and then I passed that as well. And then I was accepted to the Glasgow School of Art and Architecture. So I was working during the day and going in the evening to study.
Where were you living at this time?
I was living in the hostel for a while, but then I moved with a friend who studied, who became a vet later. We took a room close to the hostel. So we had our meals in the hostel, but we lived in the room because it was easier to study.
So during the term you were becoming gradually more independent of the organization?
More independent, but we were getting, I was earning, well, when I started I got 15 shillings a week, and then I got £2, and then £2.10 a week. As I was earning more, I would get less help from the organization.
Presumably once you arrived in England you learnt a lot more about the organisation that had brought you to England. Was
not a lot. We didn't learn a lot about them, but I didn't myself pay much attention to it. I think when you receive charity, I don't believe in gratitude. We took it sort of for granted that someone helped us and that's all, that was all.
What did you know of the organization? What did you know who?
There were rich people, rich Jewish people who gave money and began and paid for the teachers, and the buildings belonged to them, and they let them. That happened all over Britain, and somehow, I took it for granted. I didn't want to think about it or. Didn't give much second thought.
How long did you remain in Glasgow?
Until 1949. And many of my friends, you see, the office wanted to keep me because I was doing quite well and they liked me. But many of my friends left Glasgow, and some went abroad, but the largest group of my friends were in London, so I decided to come to London in 1949, which I did. I easily found a job. There was another hostel where I stayed for a few weeks, and I found digs. I started earning £8 a week, which was enough to keep me going. I went to the Northern Polytechnic, studied in the evenings. And so that's how I came to London.
Although you are now, for the most part, completely independent of the organisation, did the boys who'd come together to England keep strong contact with each other? Did you keep in touch a lot?
Yes, we had a club. And I didn't go there as frequently as those who didn't study, because I didn't have so much time. But we did keep in groups. The sort of groups formed, and we would meet in the club or in some. Then in the digs, for example, I moved into Swiss Cottage area, because most of my friends lived in that area, and the building where we were renting rooms was occupied by most of my friends. almost all the rooms, so we did keep somehow in touch, we kept together. But the war wasn't discussed, the Holocaust or the war, it was, we didn't discuss it at all. I didn't know that the friend with whom I shared a room for 3 years came from Lodz. It just wasn't done. There was no reason for it. We would go swimming and weightlifting and play football and volleyball and do all kinds of activities, go dancing and so on and so on. But the war was not discussed somehow. We talked English. Very few of the boys would still speak Polish. Very few and very seldom. And it just happened like
this,
that.
Do you think now maybe was this an attempt to blot it out, or was it just getting on with life?
It was to get on with life. We are in a different position. We have to get on in life. It was a subconscious. It was the right thing to do. Apparently, it didn't happen where the communities, where the survivors were much older. When I read later, 30 years later, about what happened in Holland, for example, where more older people sort of came back and survived, they formed clubs and there was much more immediate sort of reminiscences and problems and so on. And in our case, it was because we were much younger. We were the youngest as a group of survivors who came to this country.
You still keep in contact today?
Yes, we keep in contact. Many of my friends are the ones who came with me to Windermere.
Did problems occur many years later, subsequently?
Not many. And again, when I went to Israel and I met, because there are many more survivors are in Israel than anywhere else, and one of the Glasgow Jewish doctors, he was born in Glasgow, and he became a doctor and a psychiatrist in England, married an English girl, and went to live in Tel Aviv, outside Tel Aviv. And he became the head of one of the hospitals there. And somehow or other, he began to treat Holocaust survivors with psychological and psychiatric problems. And that's, I learned from him about 5-8 years ago about things which I was unaware of before. He was interested in everything that I wrote, and we were exchanging. I learned a lot from him, and I think he learned something from us as well. And he came to England to study our group, which was different from the many, many people that he treated. And he explained to me how the guilt complexes that other people had, the people who are still afraid of Alsatian dogs because of the dogs during, and also when they see a big chimney, it reminds them of the crematoria and so on. So I've learned quite a lot from him about the problems that the older survivors had.
What was his explanation for the fact that you didn't have them problems? Was it because of the age?
Because of the age. Yes, that was the main reason. The best age was sort of teenage. To be a teenage during the war was the best. Young girl didn't stand a chance. And those children who didn't have any identity at all, there were a few children who survived Auschwitz, but there were 4 or 5, and they didn't remember their names or where they had problems of identity, so to speak. We did not have those problems. We remembered very clearly our homes, but we didn't have the problems that, say, a man of 25 who already had a wife and a child and then survived. those were the people, and then of course the man of 35 who already established, and then he was relatively old and couldn't pick up the pieces, because nobody over 40, or hardly anybody over 40, had stood a chance. We were old when we were 40 in the camp. We were very old, and therefore our age was the greatest asset. And also maybe because we were isolated from the older one. We didn't go in a group. There were no older survivors with us to kind of talk about it at the time when we didn't need it, when we had to be somehow left alone and to get on with our careers, our lives.
Did you ever go back to Poland to lodge?
Yes, in 79. Ben Helfgott, you know, he was a sportsman, so he went to Poland earlier as a weightlifter, and maybe because of that he tried to organize it in 1960s, and he went, and none of us would go there. We would laugh and say, "No, who wants to go to Poland?" And that was my attitude. But in 79, when it was suggested, I said yes, and I went with my wife, and it was a very, very important experience for me, very sort of moving. I'm very pleased that I did go. Only 4 days, but so much that have happened during those 4 days. And I'm glad I did go.
Did you go back to your old home?
Yes. Yes. I went back to the old home, and the caretaker, the Polish woman, her husband died, her son died, might have been killed. She was Polish, Catholic. And she says, "Oh yes, I remember your mother, the teacher, and she was over 80, and she recollected my mother." And then she says how the Germans came in and they moved into the flat, and then they moved out. And when I went on the second floor to what used to be our flat, I found that it was in a terrible condition, like squatters, few squatting families seemed to me to be living there. And I just sort of opened the door, looked around, and walked out.
Was it an upsetting experience?
Yes, I felt as if I came from beyond the grave. You see, everybody that I knew, everybody in the area was dead. And I'm the only one coming back from sort of beyond. And I went and I looked, this is the building which was my school. This is the Plac Wolności, which is the Square of Freedom, with the monument of Kościuszko, which the German blew up and now it was restored. And this is the street named 11 listopada, the 11th of November, which was renamed Stalin Street or something, and the tram car still going, and lodge looked drab, Piotrkowska Street, which was like Oxford Street in England, it's still very busy, but it looked sort of cheap, and the buildings were not maintained. Then the ghetto area, the place where the Jewish cemetery and the buildings, there was still the hospital, and the wires of course are gone, many buildings were pulled down, new buildings built. Very strange feelings. It's very, very difficult to explain it.
How do you feel about Polish people now? And how did you react to them when you went back?
Well, I went to various museums in Lodz and exhibitions. What do I feel? We didn't get on. Jewish people and Polish people, on the whole, didn't get on. Although Jews lived in Poland for 9 centuries, or yet there was. We were somehow growing apart. I don't know whose fault it was, but two different kind of cultures. And I don't feel any hatred, but I couldn't live in Poland. I could live anywhere else in the world rather than in Poland.
Have you ever been back to Germany?
Yes. I went in 1980, I think it was 81. I had a letter from the German embassy in London asking if I would be prepared to go to a trial of a Nazi. And after thinking about it for a little while, I answered that I wouldn't mind. And it happened to be a German who was nicknamed the Boxer, who did a lot of killing in the ghetto. And I identified him from photographs, and I described the ghetto. There was a big map of the ghetto. I spent the whole day in the court giving testimony.
The Lodz ghetto.
The Lodz ghetto. And I described. He was a Volksdeutsch, he came from a town. He was born in Poland, in a town, Pabianice, not far away from Lodz. But he wasn't the chief. The chief of the Gestapo was Fuchs. But he was the one who was doing the killing. But when it came to the last sort of question, did I actually see him kill? I said, well, not actually. What I meant is I didn't really see him pull the trigger and shoot. And that wasn't good enough. They wanted an eyewitness who really saw the trigger being pulled. And I tried to explain afterwards that it's when you watch the television or film, you do see the trigger being pulled and the bullet entering. But when the shooting started, everyone was saying the Boxer is shooting again or killing. You ran away. You didn't want to look in that direction. And I am squeamish. I always turned my gaze away when people were being hanged. And therefore, I had to say, I knew he was killing. Everyone was saying he was killing. But I wasn't an eyewitness, and that was not good enough, and therefore my testimony was my being a witness wasn't successful in convicting him. But I didn't care whether he was convicted or not. At the time, it didn't make any difference whether.
What happened to him?
Then I read in the Jewish Chronicle that other witnesses were brought from Australia. What happened eventually, I don't know, because he obviously shot many people.
Did it not occur to you to tell a lie? I mean, did you not want to?
I didn't want to. Later, some of my friends say, well, why didn't you say, yes, you did see it, and he pulled the trigger, and that, why? And I felt it was important that I described what happened in the ghetto during the Sperra. This was the curfew for the 8 days, which was the most terrible. That it was important that it was recorded in the court, that somehow the records remained there, but it was completely indifferent to me of what will happen to that man.
You had no feelings of revenge?
No. I felt, well, how to describe it? If there is a higher justice, then human beings shouldn't either imprison or hang or do anything. But what is our duty? To bear witness. You see, I think he should be accused. It should be described what happened. It should be recorded. It should be, well, the more evidence is left of what happened, that I feel is very important. But if we are going to hang him for it, that is denying, to my mind, is denying that there is something. I'm not a religious person in the true sense, but I don't want to reject this idea that maybe there is some power, higher power. And if that higher power is just and the way it should be, in that case, we shouldn't deprive anyone of life. We should leave it to that higher power. Otherwise, it's meaningless, what we are.
Whilst you were in Germany for this trial, did you talk to many German people? Did you meet?
Not many. I stayed 3 days. I went with my son, because they paid my expenses. We stayed near there. I was very surprised seeing under one of the bridges in Bochum, Juden Raus. I thought, well, surely there are no Jews in Bochum. This was the, and yet there was this notice. And again, I feel somehow there are small Jewish communities living in Germany. Somehow I feel I couldn't do it. Again, I wouldn't like to live in Germany. I wouldn't like to live in Poland.
Do you think the Germans and the Poles are still very anti-Semitic? Or do you not
the
think
Poles,
that was widespread?
Well, majority of the Poles never met a Jew, so to them it is a figure from books, from cinema. Majority of the Germans, I think many of them are anti-Semitic. I think very many Austrians are very anti-Semitic, which they don't deny it. Anti-Semitism, it's a very old disease, or whatever you like to call it, and somehow, well, to say it's in their blood, again, what does it mean? I don't know, I cannot explain it. I think many people are anti-Semitic, but because we now live in multiracial community, the hatreds are diffused. I mean, many people don't like English people, don't like French people don't like the Germans, and so on and so on. Antisemitism is a. The hatred is stronger, maybe, than the hatred of a Frenchman towards a German, but there are similarities.